Hello, and welcome to the World Transformation Movement's Freedom Essay Series. I'm Tim McCartney-Snape, and this is Freedom Essay 6. Wonderfully illuminating interview with Jeremy Griffith by one of Australia's most admired journalists, Caroline Jones. This Freedom Essay features an astonishing interview between Jeremy Griffith and renowned Australian journalist Caroline Jones, who lived from 1938 until 2022, on her flagship ABC Radio National program, The Search for Meaning. Broadcast nationwide in Australia way back in 1988, as part of the promotion of Jeremy's first book, Free: The End of the Human Condition, which is a slightly different title to Jeremy's 2016 definitive book, Freedom: The End of the Human Condition. The interview was so deeply impacting, it received, according to Jones, the second most enthusiastic response in the program's twice-weekly 8-year history, and as a result of that popularity, was rebroadcast twice later that year. A veteran writer, presenter, and social commentator who spent over 50 years with Australia's national broadcaster, Caroline Jones was one of the country's most distinguished and loved journalists. In addition to receiving the industry's highest accolade, a Walkley Award for outstanding contribution to journalism, in 1988 she received the Order of Australia, AO, and the Media Peace Prize Gold Citation, and in 1997 was voted one of Australia's living treasures. We want to mention that it is clear that it will require great patience for appreciation and acceptance to develop of his human condition-solving but immensely confronting explanations. Well, this Caroline Jones interview bears that out in spades, because in it you will hear Jeremy give a perfectly clear presentation of his whole human race liberating understanding of the human condition. Yet, it has taken all of this time, 34 years in 2022, since his interview with Jones, for a real global base of appreciation and support of his work to develop. Despite so many people responding enthusiastically to Jeremy's 1988 interview with Jones, the difficulty people have fully digesting discussion of the human condition, and from there responding supportively to Jeremy's insights, meant that this interview with Jones didn't lead to any major support developing back then. We think everyone will find the Caroline Jones interview quite amazing to listen to, not only because of its depth of insight into the human condition, but also because it reveals so much about Jeremy's innocence and vision and purity of love for the human race, and his resulting endurance to bring these liberating understandings to the world. This interview also appears in Video 6 in the main videos towards the top of our homepage at www.humancondition.com.
This is Caroline Jones. My guest this morning is Jeremy Griffith, a scientist whose search for meaning has produced a book called Free: The End of the Human Condition. The book examines the conflict between conscience and intellect, the guilt this conflict has brought to mankind, how an understanding of humanity's necessary growing up period frees us from guilt, and how humans can now look forward to peace on Earth. Jeremy was raised in the country. As a young scientist, he did a great deal of work in the wilds of Tasmania on the plight of the Tasmanian tiger. With his brother, he makes beautiful furniture, which you may have seen featured on A Big Country. But his major life work to date he considers to be his new book and its passionately held ideas. At the end of our conversation, I'll give you details about the book, but let's meet Jeremy Griffith.
Shall we start talking about childhood? And maybe you'd say something about your childhood and what that was like.
Well, I grew up in the country on a sheep property and spent all my time playing with nature, I guess, in the bush. I was very fond of animals and birds, and I was fairly idealistic as a young man, and I guess all that isolation and the reinforcement I got from nature is the reason for that idealism. And the ice protection, my parents' whole background, the isolation made me an idealist.
What do you remember especially about teenage and the sort of feelings you were having then? Because it always often seems to be a difficult time for us, those adolescent years.
Yeah, I guess that's when we're orientated to life's problems. And in my case, I was extremely idealistic. I had little awareness of reality. And I guess it's through our parents that we're orientated to life. We encounter the battles on earth through discovering the battle that our parents are waging. And in my case, I saw my father as what I thought was a very good man. He almost sort of saintly, if you like. And yet the world didn't seem to recognize those qualities that I saw as so worthwhile and ideal. And I guess my orientation as a young man was to try to champion his goodness in the world. And the journeys went on and on, and eventually gained an understanding of why we, as humanity as a whole, when I say we, I mean we humanity, aren't able to acknowledge the ideals that I held in such high esteem.
Yes, and I know that has become something of a life work. I wondered, before we go into that, if you had, from an early age even, the idea of the existence of another world beyond this one which we live in.
Not really. The world I was living in, I was very euphoric, very happy. On my report card, the school said I had a zest for living. It was only much later on that I discovered the oppressed world, if you like. I remember someone saying to me, oh, you should go and listen to this person who's giving a talk, come out from America, and I went to that. And he started off by saying, oh, all those who've had some experience of another fabulous world at some time in their life, put their hands up. And then he counted the hands and he said, oh, that's usual, 70%. I usually have at some time in their life experienced an awareness of another world. But for me, I was living all the time in that other world, and I was extremely idealistic. When I went to Tasmania, I went to Tasmania to look for a rare animal. I loved animals, and I heard about this extraordinary animal in my backyard almost.
The rare animal.
The rare animal, yes. Yeah. Well, and this Tasmanian tiger, and I was fascinated, and I thought, well, no one seems to be doing anything about it. I mean, I wasn't aware of the human condition, the real problems on Earth. I thought this seemed to be the priority as I understood it, so I determined to go and try and save the animal, and I hitchhiked to Tasmania and started there and went on for a period of 6 years, and that after I'd finished my university degree in science. And I discovered then that the real problem was within ourselves. But when I came out of Tasmania, something like 28 years old, I was still incredibly out of touch with reality. It was a great mystery to me. Why the devastation of our planet, why the upset in people, the anger and aggression on Earth was a complete mystery. I mean, realists take the world of reality for granted. It's sort of self-evident. But to an innocent, to an idealist, it's an extraordinary mystery that no one's able to explain to them. I remember, for instance, I could never go to a movie and sit through a movie. The only movie as a young man I sat through was a thing about Africa called Where No Vultures Fly. And I remember when I watched Gone with the Wind, for instance, and I saw that Scarlett O'Hara used other people, I just got up and walked out because I said people just shouldn't do that to each other. I can remember going to coming out of Tasmania, being invited to this dinner party with all these important people, like John Walton, all these at that time, and I just couldn't cope. And eventually, I stood on my chair and I accused everybody of being false and fake and laughing I was furious. I was black with fury because I thought that there was a real problem. It's like living in a house that's burning down and everyone's joking and pretending there's nothing wrong. So the world of reality was an extraordinary mystery to me. I was extremely idealistic.
Was it very painful feeling separate, I suppose, feeling that you had almost a separate set of values from most others?
The pain, I mean, I was living in a state of real happiness in myself, The pain was my inconsistency with the real world and the real world's inability to acknowledge the difference, that there was something, they were silent. There was this problem on earth that no one was addressing, the suffering of others, the unhappiness of people, and no one was looking at it. And you go to university, you go to school, and they teach you mathematics. I remember asking the mathematics teacher, why are we teaching mathematics? I mean, I couldn't adopt mechanism. I couldn't evade the whole truth of the ideals of that we should be all integrative and selfless and loving and helpful and kind. Why are we so competitive and aggressive and angry? And everyone was making jokes and laughing and keeping a brave front that I didn't know. To me, it was just blatant lies and denial of the real problems on earth. And I was furious and determined to champion, as I said, my idealism and never to let it go. And I remember when my father died, he was killed in a tractor accident. My resolve turned to rock. I said, I'm never ever going to abandon my ideals. And but the incredible journey was starting out so idealistic was to finally one day discover there was a really good reason for a human upset and to learn incredible compassion for humanity. And I guess that's the journey, the grand journey adventure of humanity as a whole.
And you've encapsulated these ideas, the result of many years of thinking, in a book called Free, The End of the Human Condition. I'm talking with Jeremy Griffith. Take us into the ideas, won't you, Jeremy?
Well, let me say for a start that my book is holistic in its approach, or deterministic or teleological, the argument. In essence, it accepts integrative meaning, as I call it, integrative meaning to explain that atoms form molecules and molecules integrate to form single-celled organisms and single-celled organisms come together to form multicellular organisms and then the next layer is multicellular organisms come together to form societies and multicellular. If you like, the biblical equivalent to that would be the wolf lying down with the lamb. And at a higher order still, all things will finally come together to form the larger whole. I guess the religious equivalent for that would be peace on earth and in heaven. So there's this development of larger wholes. And holism means tendency in nature, if you look up in the dictionary, tendency in nature to form wholes. And teleological or deterministic argument is one that accepts purpose. Now, that purpose is this drive towards the development of ever larger and more stable wholes. Now, the essential ingredient to form a larger whole is selflessness. The parts of the whole have to consider the welfare of the whole above themselves. So unconditional selflessness is the ingredient for the development of larger wholes. Now, so selflessness is the essence of this whole process of development of order of matter. Integrative commitment. But you see, the great complication that rises is that while humans are a competitive, aggressive, selfish species, and if we accept purpose of integrative, there's vitalistic purpose to develop larger wholes, to be selfless, well, then why are we selfish? It seems to imply that humans and humanity as a whole is a bad species. You see, it raises the question of guilt, of the origin of sin, all these questions that religions struggle with. And as the fundamental problem that humanity's agonized for ages. And so you see, humans appear to be a guilty or bad species. Now, the paradox of the human condition is that, in fact, we are not a guilty or a bad species. There's a good reason for our apparent inconsistency with these ideals. And that's what my book explains. So that, as I said, I started out believing extraordinarily in these ideals of selflessness, only to find there was a reason for our selfishness, a good reason. The thing is that science, humanity has had to evade this acceptance of integrative meaning. So it's very dangerous, the teleological or deterministic or vitalistic or holistic approach is very dangerous, since there's a great yearning on earth at present for the new age, a great hunger that the existing world is exhausted, our planet's exhausted, we're exhausted, and the old's dying, but the new's the new world is just not able to be born. And the holistic world, the ideal world, will not gain ascension, can never be, until we find the defense for ourselves. The reason we have to, you see, it says in the Bible, for instance, that God is love, right? Love is the theme of integrativeness, this development. So really, God is our personification of this integrative development. So God, selflessness, love, integration, all mean the same thing. But we have been an insecure species, a God-fearing species, because we haven't been able to defend ourselves in the presence of God, in the presence of integrative meaning.
So what is the defense? Take us into the defense.
Well, currently, to date, we've used what I call contrived defenses for our human condition of upset, our divisive state.
For example?
There's a film out at present called The Gods Must Be Crazy, in which it contrasts the innocence of the Bushmen of the Kalahari with our mad-driven, chaotic, competitive world. But in it accounts for our competitiveness on the basis that it was due to our possessions. In the field of biology, there was Robert Audrey's book, A Territorial Imperative, which said that our competitive nature, our selfishness, is due to our imperative to defend our territory. Currently, the prevailing scientific evasion or excuse for our divisiveness is a theory called sociobiology, which says that our selfish nature is due to our selfish genes. But as I say, these are contrived defense. They sustain us until we find the real excuse. And what I'm saying is that my book is presenting the real excuse. Just before I explain what my explanation of our upset state is, I should say that that science has had to progress mechanistically rather than holistically. As I pointed out, it had to evade acceptance of holisticness, of the development of order of matter, until such time as we could defend ourselves against it, explain ourselves. So science has very properly been mechanistic. Because any acceptance of holism would only add to our sense of guilt, not alleviate it. So it's progressed by investigating reality step by proven step. But whenever it encountered a truth, a partial truth, as I call it, that was dangerous, that implied that we were bad, such as integrative meaning, it evaded it. So in science, they stress entropy, which says that systems run down towards heat energy. They don't stress negentropy, which is a physical law that explains the integration of matter that Arthur Kessler and Thierry de Chardin have accepted. They're what I call unevasive thinkers, where scientists in general are evasive thinkers. They've had to be. So science investigates the mystery, the mechanisms that might one day allow us to find an understanding. So they're evasive. Science is evasive and represses many, many partial truths that are dangerous and hides them. Now, that means that when it's finding the understanding of our souls and it's finding all these pieces of the jigsaw of explanation, but it's unable to look at those jigsaw pieces right side up. Because they are hurtful. The picture that they're presenting is a hurtful one. It's implying that we're bad all the time. So it finds these pieces of the explanation and presents these pieces upside down. Now, in the end, it requires to synthesize the full truth that will liberate us. Someone has to go in there and look at all those pieces of the jigsaw right side up and assemble the full picture that liberates us. Since the full picture doesn't criticize us, it explains us. All these partial truths tend to criticize when the full truth won't. So it's the story of David and Goliath. In the end, the whole of humanity is arrayed at the edge of this battlefield, unable to go out into it and slay this giant Goliath. An exceptional innocent is required at that time to go out, because these partial truths, such as integrative meaning, don't hurt someone who's not aggressive, angry, divisive, someone who is yet to become embattled. They're accepting, they're still idealistic. So my approach was a holistic approach, but I suggest that only a holistic approach in the end could unravel the jigsaw, could look at the jigsaw pieces right side up and synthesize the full picture.
I'm talking with Jeremy Griffith, who's the author of a book called Free, The End of the Human Condition, which embodies ideas which he has worked out, which have come to him over a period of many years. Before we go on, where does religion, the religions, fit into this picture?
Well, before I answer that, I really should explain the story. Okay. Because the story involves becoming exhausted. And then when we were exhausted, we needed religion. So just to introduce my explanation for our human condition of upset, a great battle emerged In anthropology, we know that the species Homo, which is what we are, intelligent man, emerged some 2 million years ago from the Australopithecines, who I've re-described as child man. So during our childhood and prior to that, during our ape ancestry, we acquired what I call an instinctive orientation to integratedness. In the equivalent in the Bible, it says in Genesis, we were once in the image of God. That is absolutely loving, kind, selfless, generous, all these traits. And then at 2 million years, intelligent man emerged, and a great battle emerged between this intelligent self and this original instinctive self or soul, the expression of which is our conscience. Now, we became instinctively, that is genetically, aware of what was integrative and what was divisive, what was good and what was bad. Our soul, in its conscience, is perfect in criticism but completely deficient in explanation. So the problem was the mind had to search for understanding. The fundamental problem is that a mind's a nerve-based learning system, which is insightful. It has to operate from a basis of understanding. So when the mind emerged, it had to search for understanding. There were none available. But whenever it made a mistake, the instinctive self criticized it. And it implied that we were bad to conduct these experiments in self-management when we weren't. And we got angry with innocence for its unfair criticism of us. And we have had to live with this sense of guilt, this implication that we were bad when we never were. The mind had to search for understanding. It had to make mistakes. The innocence that we needed the guidance of our conscience to tell us when we were being divisive or integrative, but we didn't deserve its criticism. We weren't bad to carry out these experiments, and it implied that we were. And had it had its own way, we would never have been allowed to conduct these experiments in self-management. So the ignorance of our original instinctive self or soul tried to stop our search for understanding. We had to defy it. We had to combat the ignorance of innocence. And so we turned on innocence and attacked it. And paradoxically, we had to start evading integrative meaning, because all our upsets that emerged from this battle, we became angry with innocence for its unfair criticism of us. We became egocentric. Ego in the dictionary means conscious thinking self. Our ego became embattled, forever trying to prove that it wasn't bad, explain itself. It was a catch-22 situation. We needed the understandings we're setting out to find in order to defend ourselves. So then we became angry and we became alienated. We started putting our fingers in their ear, if you like, to block out the unfair criticism. So the more we searched for understanding, the more angry, egocentric and alienated we became. In a word, upset, the more upset we became. And eventually a balance, we had to strike a balance. If we were too free from the imposition of these ideals, free to search for understanding, we would become too corrupt. On the other hand, if we were too obedient to these absolute truths of ideals, of integrativeness, of selflessness, we would never search for understanding. We would be too oppressed. So socialism stresses obedience to the absolute truths of being social, communal, and selfless and integrative, whereas capitalism stresses the need to be free to search for understandings. And we, as a community, vote. We say, oh, we're now too corrupt. We'll vote in Labour for a while and practice obedience to the absolutes for a while. And that becomes too oppressive and the need to be free. And so then we switch to vote in Liberals. Now, so we become more angry and more upset as we search for understanding. So what happens in the end is that we become excessively embattled. In the end, we can't live with ourselves. If we've been experimenting and our ancestors that produced us, been experimenting in self-management, we can become excessively angry. Now, what do we do at that point? We need to find our way back, scramble back to the ideal world as quick as we can, because that's the only true world there is. And our soul lived in a really beautiful place where everybody was loving and there was no anger, no ego, no alienation. And after a long search for the understanding, we're becoming just living in darkness and completely lost from the truth. We blocked it all out, at which time we have to try and scramble back. At that point, our unevasive thinkers become very precious. So historically, we've looked for our prophets. These were the odd person who'd been sheltered from exposure to the battles that humanity was waging, and who still had access to all these ideals that we had repressed long ago. And they could walk around and express truths that we'd long since lost access to. So we quickly wrote down what they said, and through them we could live again, because we could be reborn.
Who are you talking about here?
Well, I'm talking to the founders of the great religions. Yes. such as Christ, Muhammad. They were exceptional innocents, exceptionally unevasive thinkers. And that's why we murdered Christ, because his innocence only reflected on our lack of innocence that we couldn't defend. So the great paradox is encapsulated in Christ. I mean, that's why we wear a cross and things like this, because you see, while we murdered him, his innocence was the ideal that we had to repress. Humanity had to lose itself to find itself. We had to be prepared to go out and to win in the end. For the restoration of the old ideal world, we had to be prepared to carry out these experiments in self-management and cop the inevitable corruption of self that resulted. And so the presence of innocence, both was a symbol of the ideals, but it was also extreme criticism. And Christ is extremely hurtful to some people. And this whole battle. So people, once we become exhausted, we have to live off through our religion. We go and live through one of these people and we can be an effective force again in spite of our exhaustions. And it was the most amazing thing when religion came to earth. Imagine being a Mongol horde and raping and pillaging and expressing your angers to the nth degree until the end you just cannot live with yourself anymore. I remember reading about Burt Reynolds and all his sexual conquests and in the end saying, look, I got to hate myself so much. I was just desperate. And then suddenly there was these religions. I mean, very great prophets emerged who could really articulate the truth, had not lost access to that magic world and all the truths that reside there. And through them we could live again. And currently, you know, in the old days, in our more naive times, we collected our prophets. But now their great innocence only reflects on our lack of innocence. And so we repress innocence. We repress our prophets. We're mechanistic, not holistic. In our desperation at present, we're trying to find our way back to a more holistic approach. But it's a very dangerous world since it confronts us with our divisiveness that we're unable to defend. But now that we can defend ourselves, we can confront God. It's the end of adolescent man, of insecure man. We've found identity now. And all our upsets can subside now. And gradually, as our understanding of why it all was the way it was become clear to us, our mind will find peace. So this brings peace to earth, this understanding. This is what we've been in search of for 2 million years, the defense for ourselves. We can now go back to innocence and say, now listen, we weren't bad and now we can explain why. I mean, religious assurances such as God loves us, while comforting, didn't allow us to understand ourselves. We still had to find that understanding. So while we were still finding the mechanisms that might make a full explanation possible, great prophets got in the way in a lot of ways because they just reminded us of our lost world of paradise and they reminded us of our corrupted state, which we were unable to defend.
So you're suggesting really that man's journey has been a most heroic one so far.
Fabulous. We to take somebody now who's at the bottom, say that take a football, it's like being a football match, you know. Now, Ray Price comes off the football field and covered in scars and embattled and his dislocated shoulder and everything, but he's completely happy. His cup's held high and he's smiling, and we're all in Parramatta's and tears of joy for his winning. We don't worry about his exhaustions because we know the game he's been involved in was worthwhile. But humans come off the battlefield exhausted. And because we've been able to know the merit of the battle that we've been in, we can't see ourselves as wonderful. We're just insecure about our exhaustions. We can love ourselves now. We can take someone who's been, I don't know, growing up with their parents and being, you know, that having been left in the cross or somewhere, these terrible things that are happening now outside this very building. And I can take that boy or girl, and I can tell them now a story, a wonderful story that humanity's been through, an incredibly worthwhile journey. And they can then, for the first time, see themselves in that journey as being worthwhile in spite of their exhaustions. They can love themselves. And they have so much courage. I mean, they paint their hair red and they try to have an identity for themselves in spite of this incredible oppression that they're a bad person when they're not. And now they can love themselves. They can understand themselves. Understanding is freedom, is compassion.
Jeremy Griffith is speaking, and he's the author of a book which contains his thinking for the last, 13 years?
13 years.
It's called Free, The End of the Human Condition. What difference do you feel this is going to make to the world if people truly understand it and take it on board? What change could we see?
It's not like a religion. Religion depended on abandoning our thinking self, this thing that got us into so much strife, and just living through these hanging on to these ideals, which can become very important to us, because and that's where you get sort of fundamentalist approach, because those religions are what's saving us, and anything, any threat to those is challenged. But it's not like a religion. See, this is the understandings that our mind needs now. These are the tools to think with. In the past, we tried to understand that we were good, but couldn't.
What difference do you think it will make, though, to our attitude and behaviour towards the environment, for example?
Well, as I say in my book, this is the end of a 2 million years lifestyle. We will now dismantle our cities because they were. There's a book about an American now bestselling called Tom Wolfe's Bonfire of Vanities. He said New York is just a bonfire of vanity. Well, it is, and it's our egos now. Our desire to try and establish our worth. Each one of us is committed to doing, to winning somehow, to winning a game of football, to win anywhere. We are punched drunk for relief from this incessant criticism we live with. That's ended now. I mean, all our competitiveness can subside now. I mean, we'll go on playing the game we've been playing for 2 million years. It'll take a while to dawn on us that it's all over, but it is all over.
But what will be the effect of that? How will we see difference?
Well, we won't be angry. We won't be alienated. We won't be egocentric. Our great difference in personalities that we see amongst humans are all our different encounters with this battle, with the human condition. So our personalities become very similar. I mean, people who try to put down the future when they have a flash look at it occasionally say, oh, it'll be boring. But they don't understand that we've lived off the adventure and repressed the other great positives because we couldn't have those other positives. But now we can afford to look at those other positives. There's a world that we have denied and repressed of so much magic that all the things that we've collected to sustain us, lovely meals at night, sex, all these other distractions, rate absolutely nothing.
Would you see us taking more care of the world if we are truly illuminated by the idea that you outline?
Absolutely.
Yes.
I mean, I say in my book that the green movement and this desire for a steady state ecology to try and save our environment is really only a stopgap measure. We have to stop the fundamental upset within us. We have to resolve the anger, the alienation, the superficiality of people, us, you know, we have to, those things are now soluble. We can go back now and unlock all the doors that have been locked inside us. All our upsets can subside. And then we will become sensitive, incredibly aware. There's a world out there of so much beauty that we can now tap that we've never been able to tap. And occasionally a great artist might just make some cut a little window into that magic world through which we could all get a little access to the paradise. But there's a world, 1 minute of our life, 1 minute of the future, the beauty encapsulated in that would be more than all the beauty we can accumulate in a whole lifetime. There is nothing that man has created remotely compared with the magic of our lost paradise.
So what is death, then, in the scheme of things that you're describing?
The answer, if we were ideal still and hadn't become embattled and upset, death wouldn't worry us at all because we would be so selfless, so considerating, concerned for the larger whole, that our life is only worthwhile in terms of what it contributes to the whole and that we have a limited life is not a problem.
But is death in any sense returning to the whole?
Yes, we've departed on this grand journey, which has all been worthwhile. And so our life and everything about it carries on in the effort. Our effort's never lost. And that is really the true sense of our afterlife. All that we do is never lost. We say hello to someone in the morning and be kind. That goodness flows on. And everything about our life carries on. So it is true. But we don't come back as a cow, as Shirley MacLaine would superstitiously like us to believe. But we do have an afterlife, our spirit. The determination of humanity to champion this wonderful device, the mind, carries on in the work of everybody. Mm-hmm. And death, we're in our insecurity, we become very afraid of death, and it can consume us. But it's just an expression of our lost access to the truth.
And what is art?
Art is people who cultivate some access back to paradise. So they, as I said earlier, try to cut a window back to paradise so we can live through it. And they do it at great pain to themselves. Once again, if you confront beauty, it only accentuates our sense of guilt. It confronts you with our lack of beauty. So artists can, like Van Gogh, you know, they struggle so hard to grapple, to grab this rose, and all they feel is the prickles. It just accentuates the question, are we a bad species? I mean, the rest of us can just go on denying and blocking it out and not even worry about that fundamental question. But if you grapple with beauty, you're grappling with God. You're grappling with the question of our goodness. And the more you discover beauty and find access to it, the more you make your life difficult and confront yourself with our inconsistency with it. So the artists give us all a respite, a place to go. We can go and touch beauty again through them and their work.
Through music, through painting.
Absolutely.
In all those ways. What about your own art, your own craft, the making of beautiful furniture and ingenious furniture? How does that fit into your thinking? How is that satisfying to you? How is it congruent with your philosophy?
I grew up in the bush, and I've always been good with my hands, and because of a lot of imagination. And so working with wood's incredibly rewarding. It's a wonderful material. It's been with mankind all time, so we have an affinity for it. It's warm and giving. And someone said that wood has as much give and take as the human body, so it's a fair fight. It brings the best out in both contestants. So working with wood's incredibly therapeutic. See, creating things with your hands or with anything we create, we take it for granted, the magic of creativity. But it's the mind's ability to manage events that allows us to manipulate a world so effectively. So creativity is the most reinforcing of things we can do. If we make something, the reinforcement, the marvel of that creation is just stunning. We take it for granted. As I said, we've been living for so long, but really it's incredibly reinforcing. The magic of creation, of our ability to manipulate our world to our own desires, is an astounding talent. And so I think children should, television is numb. It doesn't give them the reinforcement. They should make things and be reinforced through that, the power of the ability to manipulate, to use their mind. And that should then raise the questions of the meaning of all this beauty and creativity. So making things, making furniture for me was a stage in my development towards these more serious questions.
Jeremy, what do you most hope for now?
Well, I most hope that all the suffering on the world will stop and the devastation of the earth will stop. And my effort is towards that, to try to bring peace to earth at the most critical point. And I just kept focusing my life closer and closer to the real problem, and then tried to unscramble a real problem. And that led to these explanations, which bring peace to our mind.
So will you keep moving around, speaking, as you're being increasingly invited to speak, meeting people?
I will talk to anybody. I will do anything to help explain these ideas and bring peace to people's minds, to take the pain out of our brain, to champion humans, to give us the understandings that liberate us from our upset.
And to bring us a better world by the sound
Absolutely.
Of things. Jeremy Griffith. His book is called Free, The End of the Human Condition. You can order it by addressing an envelope to Jeremy Griffith, care of Caroline Jones, ABC Radio, GPO Box 9994, Sydney 2001. And as usual with all our guests, I'll be quite happy to forward your letter on. Now, the cost of that book, by the way, postage paid, is $12. I do hope you'll join me tomorrow morning to hear Ita Buttrose.
That was Jeremy Griffith and Caroline Jones. You've been listening to Freedom Essay 6, which you can read by clicking on the Read Essay button on your device or by going to the WTM homepage at www.humancondition.com, where all the essays, books, and videos can be found. To learn more about a topic that was raised in this podcast, please go to the written version of the essay, because it includes references to other relevant freedom essays, as well as the sources of any quotes used. You can watch Jeremy Griffith present the breakthrough redeeming explanation of the human condition in The Interview. For a fuller explanation, read Chapter 3 of Freedom, and for a summary presentation of the key instinct versus intellect explanation, watch video or Freedom Essay 3. These essays were composed between 2017 and 2023 by Jeremy Griffith, Damon Isherwood, Fiona Cullen-Ward, and Bronnie Fitzgerald at the Sydney WTM Centre. I'm Tim McCartney-Snape. Thanks for listening.